You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. In today's podcast, I continue to go through the Humanist Manifesto. Once again, that's Humanist Manifesto 1, 2, and 3. Today, we specifically talk about 2 and how humanism, by definition, changes over time based on the culture because it is not fixed or objective. It's based on the experience of people. For the main topic, we go into the color code system that Jeff Cooper came up with as a means of alertness. And it's just a mindset and a way of thinking in order to maintain a situational awareness. And our matron and maiden segment today covers once again the lost arts of womanhood. And specifically, they talk about organizing in the home. On today's worldview segment, we talk about Humanist Manifesto 2. If you did not hear yesterday's podcast, I recommend you go back. I talked about and read many portions of Humanist Manifesto 1, which was first published in 1933, and the Humanist Manifesto 2 was published in 1973. And there's also a Humanist Manifesto 3, which was published in 2003. So I want to concentrate on Humanist Manifesto 2 today. And it's really interesting as you look at all three of these manifestos, and you can see that humanism as a religion, which it absolutely is not static. It's not fixed. It's not objective. In fact, by their own admission, they say that it basically just changes with the culture. Christianity, on the other hand, is based on the historical facts of the scriptures. As Christians are exhorted to earnestly contend for the faith which was delivered unto the saints. Now, the tenets of humanism are presumed to, like I said, evolve with the culture. And so the first manifesto had those 15 tenets. It really focused on things like social well-being, the enhancement of human life. There was certainly a talking about socialism. And certainly, I think communism, really, socialism is just a precursor to communism. That was very apparent in tenet 14, if you need to look that up. In short, capitalism should be replaced by socialism or communism. And the proposals or the affirmations of Humanist Manifesto 1 didn't deal with things like racism, sexism, minority rights, globalism, environmentalism, and topics of sexuality. And so remember, that was in 1933. So here we are in 1973. And so it had to evolve to survive because we had, there was also a kind of a utopian bent in Humanist Manifesto 1. And then shortly thereafter, we had Nazism, brutalities of totalitarianism with the Jewish Holocaust, the aftermath of World War II, etc. And so now that brings us again to 1973, and this manifesto has 17 tenets, and many of those topics are different than the first one. So a lot of talk about democracy, civil liberties, human freedoms, huge emphasis on the separation of church and state, all kinds of discriminations based on race, religion, sex, age, and national origin were to be eliminated. Sexuality was emphasized all the way in 1973. So there was this beginning of really the homosexual agenda all the way back here. There was also heavy emphasis on divorce and abortion. This manifesto kind of deplored the division of humankind on any kind of nationalistic grounds. It really looked for call it a new world order, call it globalism, whatever you want. That was very clear in this manifesto, and ecology. Ecology was huge. We start to see a lot of the environmental movement underpinnings in here. So even though some of these emphasis in Humanist Manifesto 2 may be worthwhile, those topics that are discussed are still hit from the presupposition of humanism. It was still a fundamental denial of anything spiritual, of anything to do with the God of the Bible. It's very clear. So I want to just read to you just a few of them. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I wanted to just hit a few so you could see this. And it's so important as we cover all of these manifestos, because you can really see them in our culture today. Our culture is fundamentally secular humanist. Okay, so I'm going to go and skip past all of the kind of the preface to the manifesto itself and go right into the tenets. So the first one, it says, in the best sense, religion may inspire dedication to the highest ethical ideals. The cultivation of moral devotion and creative imagination is an expression of genuine spiritual experience and aspiration. We believe, however, that traditional dogmatic or authoritarian religions that place revelation, God, ritual, or creed above human needs and experience do a disservice to the human species. Now, they go on and on and on about this same concept, but the bottom line is this. They say there is no room for the Bible, the God of the Bible, or any creeds or dogmas that may come from that. Another tenet here, their second one says, promises of immortal salvation or fear of eternal damnation are both illusory and harmful. What they're really getting at is as the heart of the gospel here. And they're saying they're rejecting it. They're saying there's no need for that. They're really saying is humans need economic and political goals, and they need creative values by which to live, and basically they'll be their own saviors. Okay, so this is directly taking God out of the picture and making man God. When it comes to ethics, the third affirmation, they say, we affirm that moral values derive their source from human experience. Ethics is autonomous and situational, needing no theological or ideological sanction. Okay, so the bottom line there for them is ethics are situational and they're autonomous. So therefore, they will change over time based on human experience. Now, this position is untenable when you really play it out to its natural conclusion, but there you have it. I'll go ahead and skip over that one. The fifth, the preciousness and dignity of the individual person is a central humanist value. Individuals should be encouraged to realize their own creative talents and desires. We reject all religious, ideological, and moral codes that denigrate the individual, suppress freedom, dull intellect, dehumanized personality. Okay, so once again, it's everything that is important is based on man. We start with man, and we never get to God, instead of starting with God and to understand man. Sixth, in the area of sexuality, we believe that intolerant attitudes often cultivated by Orthodox religions and puritanical cultures unduly repress sexual conduct. The right to birth control, abortion, and divorce should be recognized. Okay, they don't outright use things like homosexuality, etc. at this point, but they certainly allude to it. But they do talk about abortion and divorce, birth control, etc. Basically, there should be nothing that represses anything that they want to do. Okay, skipping down here, they supposedly are committed to an open and democratic society. Ninth, the separation of church and state and the separation of ideology and state are imperatives. Of course, they're being contradictory right here because their ideology is what they want supported by the state. The state should encourage maximum freedom for different moral, political, religious, and social values in society. It should not favor any particular religious bodies through the use of public monies, except, of course, humanism, nor espouse a single ideology and function thereby as an instrument of propaganda or oppression. 10th, human societies should evaluate economic systems not by rhetoric or ideology, but by whether or not they increase economic well-being for all individuals and groups. Once again, they propagate this idea of socialism. They kind of tone it down in this one a little bit. 11th, the principle of moral equality must be furthered through elimination of all discrimination based upon race, religion, sex, age, or national origin. Okay, this is nothing that we can disagree with, but it's the point that they take it. They go way beyond this, and it's, again, when you have your ethics not based on anything moral or not based on anything fixed or objective, where you go with this, who knows? They talk about some other things about universal education, etc., about getting rid of sexism and chauvinism and things like that. Their 12th through 17th really gets into this whole idea of globalism. So I just want to hit 14th. The world community must engage in cooperative planning concerning the use of rapidly depleting resources. Okay, so we start getting into the environmentalism aspect here, and they basically saying that it needs to be addressed on a global scale. 15th, the problems of economic growth and development can no longer be resolved by one nation alone. They are worldwide in scope. It is the moral obligation of the developed nations to provide, through an international authority, that safeguards human rights, etc. Again, based on what standard? And they say things like world poverty must cease, extreme disproportions in wealth, income, and economic growth should be reduced. Again, more socialism. 17th, and the last one, we must expand communication and transportation across frontiers. Travel restrictions must cease. The world must be open to diverse political, ideological, and moral viewpoints, and evolve a worldwide system of television and radio for information and education. Reminds me of 1984. Just real quick, I want to repeat that. The world must be open to diverse political, ideological, and moral viewpoints, except that of Revelation and the God of the Bible. Okay, so that's Humanist Manifesto 2. Hopefully you are able to see those types of things in our society today so that when you see it, you recognize it for what it is. It's humanism. For today's main topic, we're going to talk about an awareness color code chart. Now, this is something that Jeff Cooper came up with, who is famous in the self-defense world, personal defense world, very much known for his pistol craft. He started a gun sight located in Arizona, one of the most well-known shooting schools out there. Jeff Cooper was a colonel in the Marine Corps, and very well respected throughout the civilian world and the military community. His color code chart was adopted by the Marine Corps, and I'm sure many other schools and law enforcement, militaries, etc. So I just want to talk through this as it relates to personal defense. And again, what is the color code chart? It's important to understand this first because a lot of people misinterpret this chart. It is an awareness color code chart. It helps us as individuals thinking about self-defense, going about our lives, understand our awareness level around us. Okay, so it's not based on an external threat. It's an internal mindset. And that's really important to understand as we talk through it. So what I want to do is I want to talk you through these colors, and then I want to concentrate on the yellow. So basically it goes from white, yellow, orange to red. and it goes from oblivious to, I mean, you are in a fight, okay? You are in a deadly encounter in when it comes to red, in any type of situation like that. So white, again, this is really switched off. You could think of this as you're sleeping, you're napping, but it's not just that, okay? Condition white, or color white, I'm sorry, is where a lot of people stay all the time. Just for example, you see somebody walking down the road and they're texting on their phone. They are in white. They are, their mindset is on that phone. It has they have no awareness at all of their surroundings. It's a very dangerous place to be. We have to be there sometimes, obviously, when we sleep and those kinds of things. But we should never be there when we're out and about. Okay, there's no reason to be there. There are times when obviously our attention has to be diverted, but we must just be careful with that. Try to stay out of the white, basically, because that's oblivious. So I think of the person that's walking down the street, texting on their phone, the person you see coming out of a grocery store or a Walmart or Costco, doesn't matter, and they walk out in front of cars and, you know, even in a parking lot where they assume like, okay, I'm a pedestrian, I have the right of way, but they're just not aware of their surroundings. They're not looking around. This is white. Yellow. Yellow is what I like to think of as alert. It's aware, but it's also calm and relaxed. This should be a sustainable color to stay in. Okay, and it may take some practice to be able to do that. But yellow is where we should live most of our lives in. If you are out and about, you should be in yellow. If you are concealed carrier, you should be in yellow all the time. Okay. Now, there, if you go to all these blogs where they talk about this kind of thing, and you know, especially when it comes to guns, people are going to argue about this left and right. Don't get caught up in all that. The idea is to stay in a high level of awareness as much as possible. Okay, that's really the principle. You want to be aware of your surroundings. Okay, it's what Jeff Cooper called, I like to say, situational awareness. He used alertness. Okay, alertness, being aware of your surroundings. That's yellow. It's not paranoid. It's not, you're not hyper vigilant. You're not in a state of, you're going to just stress out. You're just aware of your surroundings. You're calm, you're relaxed, but you understand what's going on around you. You can pick up on cues where probably a lot of people don't. Okay. Orange, heightened level of awareness. So you sense something's not right. It's time to start evaluating, coming up with a plan. Maybe the plan is to leave. Now, this is so the big difference here between yellow and orange is orange, there is a specific cue, a specific threat. So maybe it's the two guys that walk, you're in a convenience store, you're getting a coffee, and two guys walk in and it's at night, the sun has gone down, and they've got sunglasses on and they've got hoods on. Okay, that should cue you in. You should immediately go from yellow to orange. Because you were in yellow, you noticed that, and that made you go into orange, and now you can have a plan of action. And maybe that's whatever that may be, okay, depending on what they do. But it may be to get out of that situation, maybe to put yourself in a better position, etc. Okay, red. The fight is on. You're taking decisive and immediate action. Okay, so this is the two guys that came in with the hoods. Now they've pulled weapons. Now, you know, they're trying to rob the convenience store, and they're searching for anyone else that's in the store. Okay, that's red. It's immediately been elevated to now it's life or death situation, and you need to make a decision. Either you're going to attack with aggressiveness and speed. Maybe you're going to get out of there. I mean, whatever the case may be. You know, it's time to act. All right, so that's a good overview of the color. So white, yellow, orange, and red. So here's Jeff Cooper's premise, was that you should live your life in yellow. Okay, when you're not sleeping, you're in yellow, except for those times when those visual cues, those audio cues, force you to go into orange or red, or, you know, the situation forces you to go into orange or red. Okay, so we live our life in yellow. How do we do this? How do we live our life in yellow? Well, there's many ways to think about this, but I think one of the best is again, is trying to get to that level of awareness where you can be relaxed, okay? Because otherwise, you're not going to be able to stay in this awareness level. Okay, so you've got to learn relaxed alertness. So that's not just being aware of your surroundings, but then focusing on the cues that are coming in. So it's looking at the people. You become a people watcher, really. And you're aware of your surroundings. You know what vehicles are approaching. You can tell if anything is kind of out of balance. If someone's paying too much attention to you, there's a problem that needs to be explained. Okay, I'm not saying confront that person. I'm saying in your mind, it needs to be explained if people are watching you specifically, if they're following you, if they're paying attention to what you're doing, etc. You know, that needs to be explained in your mind. One of the things that you can do, because yellow, to be in yellow, you need to have good awareness, obviously, and also decisiveness. So you need to be able to decide, okay, is this person a threat or not? Well, how do you develop decisiveness? It's difficult to develop decisiveness. It really is. A lot of times it's based on experience, and in self-defense situations, we can't really mimic those types of things unless we have really focused training. But you're not going to be able to train through being attacked, you know, in a real life situation. That's just not going to happen. Okay. Now, should you train to that level? Absolutely. If you have that ability, absolutely do that. But there's something that Cooper himself said that was probably the next best thing to training to that level, or getting experience in decisiveness. And that was going through what if situations. Okay. So what if it's at night and you're in a convenience store and you're getting a coffee because you're on the road, and two guys walk in, they've got sunglasses on, hoods. Okay. What if? Well, right off the bat, you should understand that this is a potential threat. Okay. Those types of things. What if somebody bangs down your door or knocks on your door at night? You know, what are you going to do? You know, what is your plan to be able to deal with that? Are you just going to open the door? Are you going to look to see who it is first and talk to them through the door? Are you going to be armed? Are you going to take a position of cover? I mean, whatever, you know, it is, you need to think through these types of things. It will help you be aware without being paranoid or hyper vigilant. Okay, so it's here's another example. You're driving down the road and all of a sudden you come upon an automobile that's turned over. There's severely injured people inside. You know, all of a sudden now you got to call 911. When you dial that number and they get them on the phone and they say, okay, what is your location? Are you aware of your location? Little things like that also play into this awareness color yellow. Okay, if you're in yellow, you'll be aware of your location. It's kind of a basic thing. And not only that, I mean, you're in putting yourself in a position to be able to help other people, not just defend yourself and others. You know, that again, this awareness level is an internal thing. It's not based on an external threat. So there's also the idea of like, say, a neighborhood watch. So we have this idea of a neighborhood watch, and that in your neighborhood, you're in awareness level yellow by just watching out for your neighbors. You know, you're looking, it's like, hey, the van next door at John's house, you know, is out of the ordinary. I know that he doesn't, you know, do this or that, or maybe it's just something where I text him. Maybe I'm close with him enough where we text once in a while, we talk over the fence, etc. And I text him, hey, there's a van in your driveway. Is this good? And he texts you back, says, yeah, I have somebody, you know, working on carpets. Good to go. You know, no problem. But maybe it's like, no, there should be nobody. And what's the plate number, blah, blah, blah. These types of things. Yellow. So you become somebody who looks and listens. Okay, that's really what it means to be alert and in yellow. You know, now, kind of an objection where somebody would say, I don't want to live my life, you know, hyper alert and running around and looking and listening, trying to figure out things. You know, that's what some people might say. But I think that they're thinking of it wrong. I think their impression is that you would be in this state of hypervigilance. And it's really not. Again, it's relaxed alertness. Okay. And it's just being aware of your surroundings. It's understanding what's normal. And sometimes it's just easier to see what's not normal as opposed to what's normal. And so you become that people watcher. You become that person who looks and listens, who understands kind of what's normal. And then when something happens that you may not understand exactly what's happening, but this is not normal. Okay, two guys walking in at night with sunglasses on and hoods is not normal. Now, they may not do anything, but that should cue you in. It's not normal. There was a guy, and his name was John Farnham. He was a retired Marine officer, and he had this kind of he called it the rule of three stupids. And he said you should avoid the three stupids, and this helps us in our quest for awareness. And the three stupids are: don't go to stupid places or do stupid things with stupid people. Okay, the three stupids. And that makes complete sense. You want to avoid dangerous people and places. You know, we have, even when if you're going on a vacation, you're going on a business trip, work assignment, whatever the case may be, there's no reason that you can't be in this state of yellow. All right, there's not really an excuse for getting outside, for going into the white, really. That's what we're talking about when somebody is just not aware of their surroundings. I'll also say this. If you go to the club and you get wasted, you are in condition white. That's what you've put yourself in. And so that's a personal decision, but I don't recommend it because you cannot defend yourself or others. You cannot be aware of your surroundings if you're fall down drunk. The other thing, and I guess probably the final point that I want to make with this is whether you're armed or not armed, this is a good thing for you. But especially if you're armed, if you are a concealed carrier and you have a higher level of responsibility, okay, not only to the public, to yourself, to your family, and because of this increased level of responsibility, that you need to be more aware, and so that you need to focus on maintaining this level of awareness. And so do that. And I recommend that you do become a concealed carrier. We need more people, more responsible people that are concealed carriers. We need more people that are aware of their surroundings. And then so finally, the last thing I want to say is, once again, this color coding system is not based on an external level of danger. Okay, it's an internal mindset. It's changing the way you think about the world around you. Okay, you're interpreting the world around you through the lens of this awareness, just in order to be cautious and to be able to defend yourself and others. Because the reality is, because you are a person who is only going to respond in a self-defense situation, by that very nature, the bad guy gets the initiative, okay? He gets the attack. All you get to do is counterattack, unless you are absolutely something you see coming. But either way, so that puts us at that minute disadvantage. Okay, the more we're aware, the less of a disadvantage we're going to be at. And if we can anticipate those things, we can either be in a position to defend ourselves, maybe to defuse the situation, or maybe to be able to get out of that area. Okay, so that was our covering of the four color codes today. So that's white, which is totally oblivious. It's sleep. It's unaware of your surroundings. It's drunk. It is not paying attention. Okay, and then there's yellow. It's that relaxed state of awareness. Orange, there's a specific level or specific threat and a heightened state of awareness. And then red is you're in it. There is something imminent, something's very wrong, and you are responding.
This is Matron
and Maiden.
Journey with us
as we rediscover
the lost arts of womanhood. Today on our segment, we're going to talk a little bit about
keeping your kitchen clean.
Keeping your kitchen clean. This seems like it's a pretty easy task, but I think this is one of the places that a lot of homes get out of control.
Yes.
And the thing is, the kitchen is the hub of the home.
Yeah.
It really is. Well, first of all, it has all the food, so that's where everybody's going to gather. But it's also a place that, as homemakers, we spend a lot of time. We're either
cooking.
Right. We're preparing a meal. We're eating the meal. We're cleaning up after the meal. And we're
making another meal.
Right, organizing for the next meal. I mean, that really is. We spend a lot of time in our kitchen.
Yeah.
So learning how to really keep it clean and incorporating the entire family in this process and not just all of the responsibility falling on
the mother.
Because it makes it really difficult. We wear a lot of different hats. And if we have to carry the entire burden in the kitchen, then trying to do everything else around the house, especially if you're homeschooling or anything like that, is almost impossible.
Yeah, it is. I just recently started, one day I just went to Mom and was like, Mom, I want more responsibility. I want to learn how to manage a home. And she's like, okay, well, here's the first step. And I was like, okay, no problem. And then I started doing it, and it took me like 3 days to complete it. It was making that little file box of organizing all the chores in the home. And I was, by the end of that, I was like, wow, this is really hard. How do you do this?
Yeah, it is hard. Yeah, I did. I gave her, I said, okay, so one of the first things that is important for a homemaker is to know what exactly has to be done in a home. Mm-hmm. And then you can go from there to manage it. So I had her go into each room and write a list of
everything that could be done in there.
Right.
From biannually to monthly to weekly to daily.
Yeah. You know, cobwebs, things like that. And it did. It took her several days to not only get that, go through every room, but then to write each individual chore on a 3x5 card.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then entail, what tools you will need and how often it will need to be done and things like that.
Yeah.
So we will talk more in detail about that one day, because I think that's a really neat system for somebody who is just learning how to manage a home, so you can get an idea of what you need to do around the home in order to even organize it.
Yeah.
But let's go back to the kitchen. So yes, it is. We have a lot of hats to wear, and even running errands and bringing our kids to sports or whatever. We don't do those, but we have the homestead to run.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot of outdoor things that have to be accomplished
outside
of our regular household things. So in a kitchen, what is the first most important thing, do you think, in a kitchen to help keep it clean?
To do the dishes immediately.
Okay. So does that mean that Mom stands at the sink and everybody brings their dishes to Mom and she does the dishes really quick and then puts them in the dishwasher?
No. It means right after the meal, everybody brings their own plate up and they wash it and put it in the dishwasher.
Yes. And that's something that I have taught my children since they were really young. Very, very young. And if they were too little to stand in front of a sink, I do remember us having step stools, not the double step stool. So if they were really small, I would rinse it off for them, hand it to them, and show them how to properly put it in a dishwasher. Mm-hmm. Is there a proper way to put things in the dishwasher?
Yes.
Okay, why?
If it's not organized, then things won't get cleaned. Right. Things might break.
Mm-hmm.
Things will go flying everywhere. And yeah. It's really bad. You have to keep like things with like things, and that also makes it much easier to unload the dishwasher.
Yes, because if you have all the same plates next to each other, you can quickly grab those plates and put them away.
Exactly.
If you have things just willy-nilly set inside and you've got stuff everywhere, like you said, we have had broken things because people have clumsily or without thought put something in wrong.
Yes.
They put, you know, a delicate glass, which, by the way, should have been hand-washed, but a delicate glass in next to something that was hard and was not
stable.
So it was banging and banging and banging.
And it just eventually broke. That's happened a lot.
Yeah. Well, not really a lot, but it has happened. And that's usually from somebody not doing it the way they're supposed to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to teach the children to put, you know, to care enough about the dishes that we own. When God has given us something, we should care for it. And that's that's with our dishwasher, with our dishes, whatever it may be, that these are all gifts from God. And when I talk to my kids about taking care of things, it's not because we should revere these things and, oh, I just love this thing. It's because we are honoring God, who is the giver of all good things.
Yes.
And by taking care of that, then we're showing that we're good stewards of what we own.
Yes.
Even if it's not expensive or, you know, really fantabulous, it doesn't matter.
It's not about the value of the thing. It's about your attitude of gratitude.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, teaching the children to rinse their own dishes, and even at a very young age, and if, like I said, if they're too short to reach the sink, one of two things, either let them use a step stool or you stand there, you rinse it, you hand it to them and show them how to load it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as they get older, obviously, they should be doing it on their own. By the time they can even remotely reach the sink, they should be doing it on their own.
Yeah.
And putting it in. The second thing that I did when the kids were really young is when Austin was about 3, I was getting ready to have Ella, and Sean was gone during that time. I realized I wasn't going to be able to keep up on everything. And so I put all of our plates and his cups and bowls and all those types of things, even a silverware tray down low in this microwave cart on shelves.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like, la.
Yeah.
I didn't have to unload the dishwasher anymore. He could do it. It was awesome.
Yeah.
You remember?
Oh, yeah. We had it like that until we moved to Okinawa like
3 years ago,
3.5 years ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's how I remember it. I remember moving to Okinawa and we couldn't bring the microwave cart. So everything was up high and it just seemed so weird.
Yeah, because you'd never had it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And two things that does is it allows the children to unload the dishwasher. Mm-hmm. There's no excuses of, I can't reach it, because everybody can reach it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is that allows the children to set the table. And now you can teach them how to properly set a table.
Mm-hmm.
I know that it somehow isn't popular anymore to learn manners and things like that. But, you know, even for us at home, I think it's extremely important. We never know what God is going to call our children to do. They may need some of these skills of etiquette.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you don't want to be sitting next to a person who's chewing with their mouth full and talking. And
yeah. It's happened before and it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah, it really just kind of ruins the meal.
Yeah.
And so just learning some proper etiquette. First of all, etiquette isn't about ourselves looking good. It's about making the others around us comfortable and able to enjoy their meal.
Yeah.
It is a way of
showing that you care about the person.
Yeah. Of loving somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. And so when we have etiquette and we have manners, it reflects well on family.
Even if you go out in public and say you go to a restaurant, you're representing your father, your mother, God, homeschooling. There's a lot of things that you're representing. It's a big responsibility.
Yeah. And so and as Christians, we should care.
Exactly.
How we're making other people feel. It's very important. So, anyway, you know, teaching them how to properly set a table and being able to help out. And it makes them contributors.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
Rather than what?
Consumers.
Which is what the popular thing today is. Mm-hmm. I can't even tell you how many times I have been out in public and I've, first of all, seen a child having a tantrum because they can't have something. And usually mom gives in, which always makes me sad. But also, you know, saying, I'm done, and then handing something to their parent and running off to go play. Instead of the parent saying, no, you need to go take care of that. Go put that on the counter or go put that in the dishwasher. They're teaching them to become consumers.
Yeah.
You know, that other people should be serving me. Mm-hmm. Other people should be doing things for me. And it's not about contributing to society. And in a home, a child will take more pride in their home, more pride in their family, when they know that what they've done has actually helped the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think that makes, for you, does it make a difference when you give more?
Yeah. I feel almost happier when I give more.
Yeah.
Work is a blessing to children.
Yeah. And so when you don't work, it kind of makes you feel...
If I don't, like, go outside, if I don't work around the house, if I don't cook, if I don't help take care of Hero, I kind of get a little bit depressed, honestly, for that day. Kind of like on my birthday when you're like, oh, no, I'll take care of everything. And I was just like, can't wait for this day to be over.
Yeah. Well, it's okay to rest once in a while, but I know what you're saying. It makes it easier to relax in the evening and to enjoy just a little bit of fun when you know that you've worked and you've been an integral, important part of the family.
Yes.
That we've functioned better because you've contributed something. And I think that's really the key that a lot of moms especially don't understand, is that they feel like they're doing something good for their kids when they're letting them just be kids and have fun all day. Mm-hmm. And what they don't understand is that when we as people give something back to others, we feel blessed.
Yes.
So when we are giving, it reminds us that we're important. It reminds us that our presence here is necessary, and it makes the family run smoother.
Yes.
It's a gift. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So chores and teaching children to clean up after themselves and to do those things in the kitchen. And mom, it will ease your burden.
Yes, it will.
It's hard, especially, you know, as you add more children, if you've got small kids and you're trying to do everything, you're still breastfeeding or whatever, it's hard.
Yeah.
So give yourself a break and teach your children to work.
Yes.
Especially in the kitchen. We'll talk more about the chore box that Lindy is now making. I personally think it's an important thing to study homemaking and to study home management. Look at all different kinds of systems, try different things out, see what works for you and your family. So we'll talk about some of those things and we'll review a couple of books that I think are
important.
Yeah. Things that I've read over the years that have given me little tips or little things here and there that I've implemented or used or was just encouraged in what I was already doing.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it for today. Let us know if you have any questions or comments, or you have a particular subject you'd like us to cover. If you incorporate this into your family, we'd love to hear about it. See you next time.
The following quote is from Martin Luther on the battle for the truth of the gospel. Quote, "Our warfare is not with flesh and blood, but against spiritual wickedness in the heavenly places, against the world rulers of this darkness. Let us then stand firm and heed the trumpet of the Lord. Satan is fighting, not against us, but against Christ in us. We fight the battles of the Lord. Be strong, therefore. If God is for us, who can be against us?" This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.